Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Today, we continue our look at some of the issues and candidates in the upcoming primary election in Pennsylvania. This year, voters will be electing judges to fill vacancies on several different courts. But in some states, judges are not elected. In New Jersey and Delaware, for instance, they are appointed. Later on, how electing judges can negatively affect the nature of the bench. Also, is the honeymoon over for New Jersey Governor Murphy and environmental groups? Murphy wants to see the state achieve 50% reliance on clean energy by 2030, but many environmentalists don't think the administration is moving away from fossil fuels quickly enough. But first, we've got a follow-up to a recent Radio Times show about Philadelphia's decision to burn many of its recyclables at a trash plant in Chester. Well, incineration is no longer a go-to option. And here to tell us more is Scott McGrath, Environmental Planning Director for the Philadelphia Streets Department. Welcome back, Scott.
Good morning.
So remind us, this began when China said it would no longer accept recyclables from the U.S. containing a certain amount of contamination, no more than a 0.5%, Scott, which is challenging for a city like Philadelphia.
Yeah, they went from a standard of 3% on outgoing or in bales and of recycled material that were coming in to 0.5%, which is really a standard that was very difficult for almost any processing facility around the country to meet. And that's what created the disruption in the marketplace.
So the interim solution was to send just under half of Philly's recycling load to a contractor called Waste Management for processing, and I guess in the traditional way. But then the rest went to a plant in Chester called Covanta, where it was burned to generate electricity. Remind us, Scott, were there air quality concerns around that incineration?
No, they beat all of their air quality standards that they're required to meet as far as part of their municipal waste processing permit that they have with the state. And these are very specific requirements that are actually monitored on continuous monitoring systems. So each item that's being monitored is monitored on a 24/7 basis. And right now, they don't have any outstanding or haven't had any outstanding violations from an air quality standpoint. But, and I would want to remind everybody, one of the reasons why we went this route was at the time we were asked to pay $170 a ton at our existing processor, and Waste Management at the time didn't have the capacity to handle all of our materials. So we split it up. Essentially half of our material went to Covanta and the other half went to the Waste Management Facility, which is now taking all of our material.
Okay. So, but, you know, back to incineration, obviously that's not an ideal situation. That has ended. So we're not talking about Philly being charged $170 a ton now with Waste Management. What does the new deal look like?
The new deal the range will probably, at least for the next year or so, will be between $90 and $100 a ton, depending on market conditions. Now, as we clean up the material, we have incentives built into the contract where we can actually save as much as $6, $7 a ton on the material that's being processed as we decrease the amount of non-recyclable material that we're collecting.
So, Scott, let's get into cleaning up the material a little bit more. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, one of the problems we have is when we started single-stream recycling back in 2008, our focus was just getting residents to participate. And at the time, the market value for materials was quite high. We were making about $68 a ton at the time. And our processor said, don't worry about the quality, just get the stuff to us, we'll figure it out from there. So our focus was on just getting people to participate, and we think we were pretty successful on that. We increased the diversion rate from about 4 or 5% up to almost 20%. So that was, our efforts were very successful. One of the downsides was people started putting a lot of materials that probably shouldn't have been in the bin. Whenever they weren't sure of it, they just put things in the bin.
Mm-hmm.
So we consequently got a lot of things like everything from propane tanks to pots and pans to a lot of plastic bags and all kinds of material that really isn't, the processing system isn't designed to separate these things.
So, Scott, what sort of a challenge then does it present if the recyclers come up with a pan or even just something as simple as a plastic bag? Does that gum up the entire works?
Yeah, something like the plastic bags, they get wrapped around in the equipment, and then they have to shut the whole facility down a couple of times a day just to pull the plastic bags out.
Hmm.
And other materials, if the shape, something like a coat hanger is another item that's a problem. That also gets wrapped up in the machinery, but people think metal or plastic coat hangers, that's great, I'll recycle it. But that's another item that the system is designed around separating bottles and cans. So it's looking at, and paper. So it uses the density and the shape and the geometry of the materials to separate it.
So again,
they also use optical sorting equipment.
The good news is you're almost back to 100% recycling items. The challenge is there are still items going in there that make it difficult for the system to work. I remember years ago when recycling was getting underway in earnest in Jersey, when you had different bins for paper and different bins for cans and plastics. Do you think going back to that system where things aren't single stream might make it a little bit easier for facilities to sort recyclables, especially since people are now used to the concept of recycling?
Yes, I actually worked in New Jersey when that was happening myself. And I know exactly what you're talking about. Everybody had four or five bins at the curb. People even separated the glass by color. The problem with that type of system is you had to use trucks with multiple bins. And it was a very time-consuming process from a collection standpoint. Right now, we wouldn't have if we switched to that type of system, we would need a lot more trucks and a lot more people to actually collect the same amount of material.
So it would cost more.
So going back from to a system like that isn't really a practical possibility. The other aspect of this is the processing facilities are designed to separate single stream material.
Okay.
So actually, if you separated it like that, it wouldn't really make a lot of difference because it would all get jumbled together at the plant.
Okay. So Back to the Future is not going to work when it comes to recycling. So now the city is going to pay between $90, I think, and $100, you said, per ton to have recyclables disposed of. How is the market for recyclables doing, Scott McGrath?
Well, it is improving. Mixed paper is still not worth a lot of money. It's around $5 a ton. Cardboard has increased substantially. It used to be closer to zero about a year ago. That's gone up to about $60 a ton. Aluminum cans are still up around $1,200-$1,400 a ton. And the plastic bottles that we get, those are worth close to $300-$400 a ton.
Hmm.
So there are items in there that are worth a good bit of money if we can get them in a nice clean form. Another issue that we deal with is like when people wash out plastic, we need people to clean out the plastic jars and glass jars that they generate in their kitchen. One problem we have is people don't always get all the food out of them.
So you want to see...
Food is also a major contaminant.
So you want to see them as clean, perhaps, as the dishes that go back in the cupboard?
Not quite that clean. So, yeah, if we could just a light rinsing is fine. We just don't want a lot of food and other junk in in there, what that does is that actually contaminates the paper stream, and it makes that worth a lot less if you get a lot of food in there. That's why the greasy pizza boxes are a problem, because the that contaminates the fiber that the box is in.
So, Scott McGrath, so if you see, if the recycling program then picks up and you see more compliance with cleanliness and et cetera, do you see the figure that Philadelphia is paying to dispose of its recyclables eventually going down?
Yes, it will go down. As we build, we're already starting to see domestic markets starting to develop in this country. A number of older abandoned paper plants have been bought by U.S. manufacturers as well as some overseas firms. So that capacity is starting to develop again, but it's going to take a little bit of time to bring these new plants back online. There's already some capacity in the U.S. to handle the aluminum as well as the some of the plastic materials. So that's sort of there. It just has to be developed, and it takes time and money, capital investment, to sort of get these plants up and moving again.
So recycling, as opposed to going to the landfill, more cost-effective?
Right now, not necessarily, but from an environmental standpoint, yes.
Sure.
If you look at the long-term environmental costs, it is more cost-effective.
So, again, the good news is Philly, I guess, is probably 99% on board with recycling and very little incinerating at this point. Right, Scott?
Right. Yeah, a portion of the residual material that's processed at the that they can't sort from the recycling facility, that material, some of that may end up either being used as a engineered fuel product or used or sent to a landfill, depending on the type of material.
So how are Philadelphians in general, Scott McGrath, with recycling? How would you grade compliance?
I think we have a very enthusiastic public, I guess is probably the best way to put it. I think there's a lot of desire there to put the right stuff out, and I think we're just going to have to kind of retrain our public so they know what we want them to put out curbside. So I think the good part about of this story is if you look on any collection day, you see a sea of blue bins out there, and there's lots of enthusiasm for recycling in Philadelphia. Even as we've had problems in over the last 6 or 8 months, we found people haven't stopped recycling, which is really a good sign.
All right, Scott McGrath of the Philadelphia Streets Department, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, New Jersey's move to 50% renewable energy. The goal is 2030. Danielle Moyo of Politico NJ will be along to tell us how the state is doing with that goal. Stay with us. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy campaigned on a promise to make the state 100% dependent on clean energy by 2050. The more immediate goal is to get to 50% by 2030. But as the hard work begins, is a sobering reality setting in. Murphy is a progressive whose election was cheered by environmental groups, but many of those same groups are now growing impatient with the administration, especially when it comes to delays in a promised energy master plan and questions regarding the future role of fossil fuels. Danielle Moyo is a reporter for Politico NJ, and she's here with us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's begin with efforts to throttle back on the use of fossil fuels. A coalition of environmentalists called Empower NJ wants, among other things, a moratorium on fossil fuel development in New Jersey. And according to this group, there are at least 8 natural gas pipeline or other projects in the works, as well as, is it 4 natural gas-fired power plants? These projects obviously would not move the state away from dependence on fossil fuels. And it seems as if the Murphy administration might have taken a step or two back from this difficult question. What's your perspective?
Yeah, well, so something that Governor Murphy has repeatedly said is that he wants to look at these sort of complex issues of the expansion of gas pipelines as part of the Energy Master Plan. And that is a plan that's released under every administration that basically outlines their energy goals for the next 3 years or so. And so what environmentalists had been pushing for was for the administration to say that they were going to put a gas moratorium in this plan. But the plan is now delayed. And the issue with that, they say, is there's going to be some big pipeline decisions coming up before this plan is released. So they're looking for more clarity on how is the administration going to handle this? And are they going to kind of keep kicking the can down the road on this difficult question?
Well, among the pipelines, there's this $1 billion Northeast Supply Enhancement Pipeline. I think that's what it's called. Also, the Southern Reliability Link, or SRL pipeline, which is underway in Ocean and Burlington counties. This gas pipeline will cut through the Pinelands, which is environmentally sensitive. There were protests last week. So it seems as if that is the indication that since these projects seem to be moving forward, at least on some level, that this will be part of the Energy Master Plan. Natural gas will be part of that master plan.
So the Murphy administration, this is actually kind of their first big test with the Northeast Supply Enhancement Project, because the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection has the authority to block this pipeline under the Clean Water Act. And this is something that New York has used before on other pipelines. So Governor Andrew Cuomo blocked the Constitution pipeline using the state's authority under the Clean Water Act. And New Jersey's never done this. And environmentalists are looking for him to do so. So right now, that pipeline has been approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Authority, but New Jersey could theoretically come in now and block that pipeline. And the Southern Reliability Link, they're also looking for the New Jersey DEP to revisit that pipeline because its initial approval was contingent on the refiring of an old coal plant, and that plan is no longer happening. So they're saying this is another opportunity where the state can exercise its authority and block these two pipelines.
Well, again, we've got this goal of 50% renewable energy by the year 2030. Obviously, wind and solar must be a part of this. But is the Murphy administration, in your opinion, just facing a hard reality that it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to get to 50% renewable energy without some sort of support from natural gas and nuclear, along with increases in wind and solar? And
yeah,
how is his relationship with environmental groups? I mean, a lot of them are really aggravated with them, are they not?
Yes, they're definitely aggravated with him. I mean, look, objectively speaking, 75% of New Jersey households right now rely on natural gas as their primary heating fuel. If you want to get to a 100% energy goal by 2050 or even the 50% milestone, you have to limit dependency on natural gas. And if you approve these pipelines, I mean, these are projects that are bound to continue running for at least 50 years. You can't say that you support a renewable, 100% renewable energy goal and also approve new natural gas infrastructure. And this is where environmentalists are getting aggravated, where they're saying you can't just tout, the offshore wind goals or the solar goals, because if natural gas is part of the mix, you're never going to get there.
All right, let's talk about wind and solar for a moment. Governor Murphy wants to see, I think it's 3,500 megawatts of offshore wind generation by 2030, which would conceivably power, I think the figure is over a million homes. We could know which company will develop the first 1,100 megawatts by the end of next month. So is that effort, the effort to develop wind energy, moving along and perhaps moving along more quickly than it did under the Christie administration?
Yes. I mean, the Murphy administration has made wind a very big focal point. I mean, when the governor took office, he signed an executive order to create the subsidies that will allow offshore wind to move forward. And since that time, the state is now reviewing applications for, like you said, 1,100 megawatts of offshore wind. And we're going to know who the winner or the winners are in June of this year. So that's been moving along very quickly. The regulatory agency was very responsive to making sure that happened quickly, to ensure that these companies could get as many incentives as they could and lower the cost to ratepayers. So we'll know more soon, but yeah, it's fair to say that they've acted quickly on that, and we're seeing that moving forward rapidly.
Danielle Moyo of Politico NJ, what were some of the objections to developing wind energy under previous administrations, do you recall?
Yeah, it definitely was cost. I mean, that's always been the biggest concern. Since the Christie administration, cost has declined. That's just due to, you know, improvements in technology over time. So there has been kind of a running joke among environmentalists that waiting turned out to almost be a good thing for New Jersey in a sense. But that's always been the primary concern. And especially now when the Murphy administration is tackling so many energy projects, they just approved a $300 million annual subsidy for nuclear. I mean, cost is still a concern. You want to, you know, at the end of the day, New Jersey ratepayers are going to be subsidizing offshore wind. So you have to make sure you're not burdening them with too many costs on their utility bills.
So let's get to nuclear power. Is New Jersey's, it is New Jersey's largest source of carbon-free power at this point. Look, the state's aging fleet of reactors. Danielle, how would you characterize the viability of this fleet overall? Many of them have been around for decades.
Yeah, it honestly, it's been a fascinating topic to cover nuclear power. So the PSEG owns three nuclear plants in South Jersey, and they have been pushing for a long time for subsidies to help these plants continue running. Nationwide, you know, there's been this big concern that with fracking, the cost of cheap natural gas is putting pressure on these older nuclear power plants and that they can't compete in energy markets. So New Jersey was kind of the latest state to try and tackle this issue by subsidizing these plants, which essentially just means, you know, putting a charge on residents' and businesses' utility bills to help pay for them. However, you know, the big political fight that occurred in New Jersey had to do with whether or not these plants really needed the money to continue operating. And two independent agencies found they were financially viable, and the state's own energy regulatory staff found that they were financially viable. But they approved the subsidy anyway.
Well, what happened there? Why was the subsidy approved?
Essentially, PSEG put the state in kind of an impossible place. They filed notice with PJM, that's the regional transmission operator that New Jersey is part of, saying that we're going to close down these plants if we don't get the money. So they made that a formal notice, and you can imagine the threat of that significant loss of jobs and also, like you mentioned, the largest source of carbon-free power put them in a hard place. And so you had the regulatory agency essentially saying, we know these plants aren't financially viable, that they are financially viable, but we're going to approve the subsidy anyway because we don't want to see them shut down.
So a $300 million subsidy has been approved. What are ratepayers going to see in terms of an increase on the bill?
So residents we'll see on average $28 per year. So, but the more significant cost will be to larger energy users. So think of hospitals or manufacturers. The state has never provided an estimate for what that will cost them. When asked, they've just never provided one. A coalition that represents large energy users has said it could cost, you know, as much as $500,000 a year to $1 million. So we're talking about significant costs.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
No, Oh, yeah, and it could be, you know, enough to encourage businesses to maybe look elsewhere where the cost of electricity is cheaper.
Guessing environmental groups were not happy about this subsidy approval as well. I mean, nuclear facilities are carbon free, but they come with their own brand of waste, which is especially toxic, the storage of spent radioactive fuel rods. Is this an active part of the environmental conversation, Danielle, or is it being shelved for now because of efforts to battle climate change?
So environmentalists were very opposed to the nuclear subsidy. Like you said, they don't really count it as a clean source of energy because of nuclear waste. And the other argument they made was, well, by approving this, you're leaving less money to subsidize things like offshore wind. So they were opposed to it. You know, at this point, there's not much they can do. Some have, you know, not environmental groups, but the division of the Rate Council, which represents New Jersey ratepayers, has said they're looking into possibly, you know, filing a lawsuit over this. So there could be appeals that we see. We've seen that in other states who have enacted similar nuclear subsidy programs. But, you know, as it stands right now, the best they can do is kind of now channel their energy on natural gas infrastructure and trying to block that as much as they can while ensuring wind and solar moves forward.
Okay, back to the Energy Master Plan, which, as you mentioned earlier, has been delayed. I think I read we might see this, or at least a draft of it, in June. The head of the Board of Public Utilities has indicated that nuclear power and natural gas might be part of a bridge to 100% reliance on clean energy. So it seems as if we're probably going to see these two energy elements being included, if I had to guess, or perhaps if you had to guess, in the master plan.
Yeah, it does seem that way. I mean, Joseph Fiordaliso, who's the president of the Board of Public Utilities, has repeatedly said that he sees these as a bridge. Something that some, you know, there's been some speculation of maybe the plan will include a moratorium on gas infrastructure later on. I mean, that still would not be what environmentalists want. They want to see it now, but that, you know, we could see that theoretically in the plan. But I think the issue is, when will it come out, and how will it tackle these pending pipeline decisions that you can't really overlook when trying to put together a 100% clean energy goal?
Danielle Moyo, how is the solar market doing in New Jersey?
Solar has been strong. They recently announced that they've installed 100,000 solar panels. They're looking to change some aspects of solar in New Jersey. One thing they're trying to do is change how they subsidize solar to make it cheaper for ratepayers, so they're not paying as much for solar panels. And they're also looking to advance community solar projects. And these are projects where, if you're a renter who doesn't own a home, or you're a low-income ratepayer who can't install solar panels on their house, you could still buy solar from, you know, a field in a different part of New Jersey. So they're trying to advance those two things, making it cheaper and more accessible to more people in New Jersey.
Energy storage is a critical part of the plan to move to clean energy. Tell us about that, energy storage.
Energy storage was a part of the clean energy bill. And yeah, that's key, because basically, if you're going to be moving forward with things like solar, you'll need energy storage, basically, or wind. You'll need to have it store those forms of power for when it's needed later. So they always say the wind's not always blowing, the sun's not always shining. Energy storage ensures that you kind of always have that renewable power on hand. So the clean energy bill calls on the state to get 2,000 megawatts of energy storage by 2030. That's a significant goal. And right now, state regulators are looking at the way to install that energy storage in the most cost-effective way.
We are speaking with Danielle Moyo, an energy and environment reporter for Politico NJ. And we've got a question from Earl. Is there any research being done on the difference between white solar panels and black solar panels? Not sure you have that information at hand, but can you take a crack at that one?
It's not something that the state agency, the BPU, is currently looking at. At least if they are, they haven't made that public. But it's an interesting question, and I'll be seeing them on Wednesday, so I'll be sure to ask them.
All right, thanks. Also, Danielle, environmentalists want to see a dedicated fund for New Jersey Transit. Why is this, and is this in the pipeline?
So, yeah, so New Jersey Transit, I mean, you know, it can't be said enough. Vehicles are the largest source of emissions in the Northeast. So clearly, if you're an environmentalist, you have to be pushing for more people to take NJ Transit. Right now, you know, I mean, Governor Murphy has said his goal is to channel more funding into NJ Transit. Those negotiations are going on as part of the budget, so I'm sure we'll learn more as budget negotiations continue throughout this month and next month.
So again, as an observer, do you think New Jersey will be able to hit the 2030 goal of 50% renewable energy? What do you think?
I actually do. I mean, I think with offshore wind, you know, it depends how they look at it, right? So nuclear power accounts for 40% of carbon, roughly 40% of carbon-free power in New Jersey. So if you count nuclear, I mean, they're almost there. I don't know how they're dealing with that question. It's a good question, but if they are, and you add this lofty offshore wind goal that they're advancing in the next couple of years, I think it's feasible. What is much harder is that 100% pledge by 2050. And again, I mean, if you approve natural gas pipelines, if you don't do more to decrease the reliance on heating fuel oil, it will be difficult. So
got to stop you there. Thank you so much, Danielle Moyo, energy and environment reporter for Politico NJ. Great to have you along. Up next, David Thornburg is president and CEO of the Committee of 70. We're talking about judicial elections in Pennsylvania. Keep it here. This is WHYY. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Pennsylvania is a state in which judges are elected as opposed to being appointed, which means there are campaigns for the bench, money that must be raised and spent in the effort to win election, and concerns about ballot placement. If a candidate doesn't land a prominent, eye-catching position, they risk losing no matter how well qualified they are. Also, a judge's relationship with the citizenry is very different than that of a mayor or lawmaker. They hold a lot of sway, for instance, in decisions regarding criminal or civil matters. So, what does a voter need to do to choose the best possible judicial candidates? David Thornburg is president and CEO of the Committee of 70, a nonpartisan organization which advances representative, ethical, and effective government in Philadelphia. Welcome back, David.
Thank you, Mary.
There are vacancies on Pennsylvania's Superior Court and the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas and the Philadelphia Municipal Court, so voters have a lot to consider coming up on May 21st. The fact is, a lot of us don't have much information heading into the voting booth. When it comes to judicial elections, one of the issues is candidates can't go all out when it comes to campaigning. Why is that? You know, talking about their positions on certain issues, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, let's say as a blanket statement that electing judges at all levels, as Pennsylvania does, is highly problematic. And I think you point to one of the complexities that makes it problematic. I mean, essentially, we don't want candidates for a judicial role to be sort of signaling how they would decide on a particular case. That is seems unfair and unwarranted. The other thing that we're that makes this problematic is judges also weigh in on the structure of how we make decisions. So I think you mentioned cash bail is a big issue these days. So paradoxically, we've got people running for office and raising money and courting voters and so forth who are not really allowed to, nor should they properly, let us know how they would be making decisions.
And so, yet they do campaign on some level. So what are the parameters? What can they do?
Well, it's they have to thread the needle. They have to talk about their experience, what they've done with their lives, their education. You know, you can talk about stuff you've done in the past, as long as it doesn't signal how you would rule on a case or how you would come out on one of these sort of governance reforms. So it's go back to what I said at the outset. It's highly problematic. And we can talk a little bit later. There have been reforms seemingly in the mix forever to try to move to a different process, at least for some of the courts. But we're stuck with it right now.
And voter information obviously is critical. What are the resources out there? If a judge can't talk about his or her positions on certain issues, you know, which obviously they shouldn't be bringing up anyway.
Yeah.
Where can a voter go for information?
Well, one of the things that we've tried to stress is that our local bar association, the Philadelphia Bar Association, does a very credible job of evaluating judicial candidates.
What do they do specifically?
Well, it's as befit the legal profession, it's involved. There's an official evaluation commission. They ask candidates for questionnaires, and they end up not endorsing candidates, but giving a highly recommended, recommended, or not recommended. So, if all else fails, our simple advice to voters is use the Bar Association recommendations. You can find them on the Bar Association website. You can also find them on our website at 7D.org, where we have a complete nonpartisan voter guide that also allows you to evaluate candidates, download them to your phone, and take them with you to your polling place or share them with others.
So, are there resources you like, or is the Bar Association the top?
That's really kind of the one-stop shop.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if if you have a chance to meet a judicial candidate and to kind of give him or her the kind of up-close and in-person test, that's fine. It helps to know who these folks are, I think. But beyond that, I mean, the sad thing, you know, in making our sense of how tough this challenge is, what influences a lot of particularly local judicial elections is ward endorsements. You know, we have 69 ward leaders on each Republican and Democratic Party, and essentially our judicial candidates raise money to pay ward leaders in exchange for an endorsement. And then that some part of those funds is used to hire people on election day to stand out in front of your polling place and hand you a sheet that says, here are the endorsed candidates.
So they pay ward leaders?
Yeah.
And that's all on the up and up? That's legal?
Yeah.
The candidate which comes up with the most cash gets the endorsement, conceivably?
Welcome to Philadelphia. as I said at the outset, this is highly problematic. But what we found over time is that and I'll mention another thing that makes your head spin. You know, the two single biggest factors in ensuring a judicial race to date are ward endorsements and then ballot position.
Yeah. In Philadelphia, it's the horn and hard art coffee can.
For judges, it's not technically. They're not drawing out of the same can. They use a similar process in Harrisburg, but it has the same result. It randomizes the process by which you end up on literally the physical ballot, which sounds fair at the outset, except you start to realize that on a very crowded ballot, which we will have on May 21st, primary election, certain parts of ballot real estate are more valuable than others. Upper left-hand corner of the ballot is the sweet spot. That's sort of the number
one. That's where
one.
A person's eye would fall automatically.
Because it's how we read.
Yeah.
We read left to right, up to down. So voting Siberia is sort of lower right-hand corner because people's eyes just don't go there as quickly. And there's a little, it's a funny dynamic. When people walk into the voting booth, I think sometimes they're anxious. They don't want to hold people up. They're overwhelmed. So a lot of times, too many times, people don't even vote in the judicial elections because they want to kind of make sure that they get on with it, or there are too many candidates, or they feel intimidated because they don't know enough. I mean,
so how does a low voter turnout, if you will, for this particular type of election affect the bench negatively?
Well sadly,
or how can it?
I think it gives more prominence to the ward endorsements and the ballot position. So, you know, the only defense against this is to pay attention to the endorsements, as I said earlier, and the Bar Association does a great job and has been trying to educate people on the value of their endorsements. So that's something we've been anxious to promote as well.
And not be concerned about taking a moment to look through.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I read that there are 6 judges' positions on the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, but 25 Democrats running. So, you know, you got to take a moment to look through all those names.
Yeah. It's actually a little lower than it was. My first election at the committee, when I was hired at the Committee of 70, was 2015. And I think there were 40-something candidates. So, in contrast, I guess voters have it a little bit easier. But if you're going to vote, and we certainly hope everybody's intending to vote and making a plan to vote, you owe it to yourself and to the men and women who are campaigning out there to do a little homework on the, the irony is, in the history of the Republic, it's never been easier to find out something about the issues and the candidates.
Sure.
And you folks do a great job. The Inquirer and the Philadelphia Media Network does a great job. Our voter guide reaches about 75,000 people around the region. So stuff's out there. You just need to take a minute or two before you head off to the polls.
Back to money. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the cost of a Democratic city committee judicial endorsement is $35,000?
Yeah, ballpark.
Really?
And you hear horror stories about judicial candidates who take out a second mortgage or cash in some retirement savings. It can be financially ruinous for candidates to enter into this kind of goofy process.
So, David Thornburg, where do discussions of merit find a place in judicial campaigns in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Well, there have been... Let me rewind for a second. We ended up with the way we pick judges starting back in 1850. So this is a longstanding issue. And periodically there are moves to reform the process by substituting some kind of a merit selection process. Most notably, this came up as a head only 50 years ago in the Constitutional Convention that advanced a referendum to the polls in 1969 that unfortunately, in our view, the voters narrowly defeated. So they said, we'd actually like to continue to elect Commonwealth Court, Superior Court, and Supreme Court judges. There is a new proposal, Phoenix rising again and again from the ashes. There is a new proposal in front of the legislature that would create a merit selection system, not for the lower court judges, not for common pleas and municipal, but for the appellate court judges, which is, you know, sort of a backstop at the end of the road. So hope springs eternal. There's a terrific group called Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, which we helped create back in 1988. That has been carrying the water on these issues. And so there is some momentum.
So hope springs eternal, but what's the political reality? Do you sense that there's a change among lawmakers on the state level to move forward on merit-based selection?
I think there is. I think the tide is definitely moving in that direction. And, you know, we're in an
era. Why is that?
Well, partly because I think everywhere political leaders turn, they're seeing voters angry about the political process. It's sort of a blunt force emotion. It's just, I'm sick of this. You people are yelling at each other all the time. So maybe in that context, when elections are more and more angry and partisan and negative, maybe there's sort of a swing back that says, you know, if we chose judges, and it feels so fitting to choose a judge this way, exercising some judgment and some preparation and some nonpartisan or bipartisan process, it feels reasonable.
So as we mentioned earlier in the segment, in New Jersey and Delaware, judges are appointed. Appointment versus election, pros and cons.
Well, Pennsylvania is one of only 6 states that elects judges at all levels. And if you trace this back to the source, I think the source is that, you know, we believe in Pennsylvania that voting provides a level of visibility, accountability, awareness. It's sort of small d democracy. And that permeates a lot of the way we govern in this state. The problem is, and we just talked about it, that despite the fact that information is available, a lot of folks just simply don't know who they're voting for. And as we said, in fact, it's problematic because we don't want judicial candidates to telegraph where they are. On the merit selection side, you know, it's important to recognize every living governor endorses merit selection of some sort. So the plus side of that is you get a measured, rational process that involves some level of compromise. It's not, you can't totally take politics out of the process.
I was just going to say, politics is still inherent in the process, but perhaps less with appointments.
Yeah, I mean, we're just trying to move the needle on the scale of partisanship. I mean, it's worth noting that in the last Supreme Court elections, candidates raised and spent $16 million, which is the most raised for statewide judicial elections in the history of the Republic in any state.
So and appointment takes the money out of the equation.
That's right. That's right. And I think most merit proposals have also included a retention election feature, which means you might get appointed on the first round, but then maybe 10 years later, voters have a chance to say whether you should continue in that role. So there are ways to sort of add some political checks to what otherwise looks like a inside process.
Let's take a look at the time spent on the bench. These elections, 10 years, 6 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time, and these are consequential decisions. I mean, I think that's what is important to recognize, that at the lower levels, common pleas and municipal court, these are, you know, could be felony cases, could be major crime cases, even everyday life, they're traffic court, essentially, kinds of cases. So those involve, everyday people and everyday decisions. At the higher levels, at the Supreme Court, you know, we're talking about rulings that influence the way the state is governed. We've been very involved in the redistricting reform effort and the pushback on partisan gerrymandering, trying to push back on the role that politics plays in setting elected districts. And a lot of folks know now that the state Supreme Court last February ruled in favor of the plaintiffs who said, you know, there's too much politics in the process and put in place new congressional maps. So mm-hmm. Yep. That's the kind of fundamental decision that shows up at the highest level of courts in Pennsylvania.
What would you like to see in terms of term limits?
Term limits for judicial
candidates?
Judges?
Yeah, judges, yeah.
Well, I mean, I haven't really sort of looked at that in depth.
4 years as opposed to 6 to 10?
I think a longer term, as long as you can have a retention option down the road, sort of makes sense. I mean, you have to take time, maybe more so than being a legislator or being an executive. You have to learn to become a good judge. So I'd be willing to see a longer term, not 2, 4, 6. Again, as long as we could keep that retention piece down the road.
Okay. And to close, just remind us again what's at stake here when judges are elected to the bench as folks in Pennsylvania prepare to go to the polls May 21st.
Sure. Well, you've got a slew, let's use a technical term, a slew of candidates on the ballot for Superior Court, for Municipal Court, and Common Pleas Court. Easiest shortcut is to look at our website, 70.org, to learn about candidates and to use the Philadelphia Bar Association recommendations in guiding your voting.
All right, David Thornburg, always a pleasure to have you with us for Radio Times. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Mary.
David Thornburg is president and CEO of the Committee of 70. And don't forget, you can connect with us on social media. We've also got some terrific podcasts lined up for you. You can find everything at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.